Okay, so let's get into other items. Now let's get into the power of attorney for property and the power of attorney for healthcare, Rob.
What's his name?
Peter. Rob is the guy moving in. That's why I had him on my mind.
There's always something.
There's something. Mm-hmm. This mind is just full of stuff.
True.
Civil War, nostalgia.
Mini balls, yes.
Mini balls, yeah. Ammunition. Mm-hmm. Hot tubs and garage doors.
Mm-hmm. It's just a plethora of information. Mm-hmm. You never know what's coming out because there's no script on this show. So we promised our listener in Duluth we were going to get to all four of these. We're running out of time. Let's get to power of attorney for property, something that I try to drill into the hearts and minds of my clients all the time on how important this is. What is this document, Pete, and why is it important?
Well, the document is one that's put together by a person where they appoint someone to stand in their shoes to take care of their finances as they would in the event of their mental incapacity, not physical, but mental incapacity. And without it, the default is going to court and having a conservator, at least in Colorado it's called a conservator, to be appointed by the court to manage the incapacitated person's financial assets.
And they have to do it wearing the shoes of the other person?
Well, they can change shoes, but as long as they're the shoes of the person, yes.
So they have to wear the person's shoes in order to do this?
Well, they don't. They just stand in the shoes. They don't really have to wear them around
just
too much.
Just stand in
those
shoes. Yeah,
that's all they have to do. Yeah. But if they're boots, I'm not sure if that works.
How about sandals or flip-flops on a hot day?
They may not be shoes, though. I think it has to be a closed-toe type of apparel.
All jokes aside, this is something, Chris, we see a lot in the office because a lot of times, Peter, people come here and...
You're going to need to wear a name tag for a while.
I'm getting it. I'm getting it.
There's that little hesitation. Yeah. Peter.
Oftentimes, people will come here and they'll have their IRAs here or they'll have some sort of brokerage-style account and... I have to explain to them, just because you are married does not mean your spouse can come in here, access money from your IRA, because an IRA is individual. That's what the I stands for, individual. So it's not a joint account. Your wife can't come in and say, hey, my husband is incapacitated. I have to provide for his care. We need some money from his IRA. I cannot send it to them. I cannot act on anyone else's direction except the incapacitated person.
Correct.
And if they are incapacitated, if they're in a coma, or if they're not able to communicate, or if they are under the knife in an operating room or something that has enacted this incapacitation, I can't just act on the will of the spouse. And I tell them even married people need a power of attorney. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. And even property that's owned jointly, for example, that requires both signatures. It used to be brokerage accounts did, but now that's not too much the case. But, for example, a home and say that they need to downsize and maybe they want to sell that house and the spouse wants to move to a place that's closer to where the incapacitated person is, they can't sell that house without the authority of the incapacitated person and they lack the legal capacity at that moment to consent to anything. So there needs to be something done.
So, again, I have seen these documents. They're not overly thick. They're a few pages long. A lot of them are legal mumbo-jumbo. But
that's a legal term.
That's a legal term. But in essence, it is a document that you grant the power to another person to wear your shoes and fill in for you. Now, do you recommend multiple, they call them agents, do you recommend just one agent or do you recommend multiple and making sure all of them agree? Because one thing I tell people with the POA, it is a very powerful document. And it grants someone at your incapacitation when you are least able to take care of yourself. You're not here mentally. So you can't second guess and question what's being done. And it allows that person the ability to come and essentially drain your account. Because when someone comes into my office with a POA and says, I need to take X amount of dollars out of this person's account, I don't ask for receipts. I can't. I can't say, whoa, well, wait a minute. Show me the receipts. What are you doing with this money? prove to me that it's going to be used for the incapacitated person. They just simply come in and say, here is the POA, here is the incapacitation proof, and I'm enacting this POA. Do you recommend multiple agents where they all have to agree as a means of protecting, or is that being overly cautious, or will that cause a lot of unnecessary delay? And do you recommend any type of contingency plans in case the agent named is incapacitated themselves or no longer wants to do it?
Well, let me go at the last question first. And yes, we always recommend that there be a backup agent in the event that the agent that the person has selected is not available, maybe incapacitated themselves, as you suggest. There may be a number of reasons. They may be out of the country. It could be any number of things. So we always want to have a backup, one at least. Two is even better, so we would have three people named, and they would serve consecutively depending on availability of the predecessor. So that's the first thing. I have prepared powers of attorney where we have more than one person acting as the agent. The issue there is they have to agree, and that may be a good thing. It may be a bad thing, and if they have a disagreement on a particular expenditure that is really for the person's benefit. It's not like someone's taking the money, but if they don't agree, then the money is not available to satisfy that obligation, whatever it might be. So it can work together. It can be an advantage or disadvantage. I don't recommend that there be more than two necessarily, because then you're into a committee, and a committee takes forever to make a decision. Now, I have done it where it's a majority of maybe three people named. Say all three kids are on the power of attorney. Then two out of the three can carry the day on a particular decision.
Do you have another question?
No.
Okay.
Just
then,
absorbing it all.
To carry on with this POA, so we have the document. It can be one agent or multiple agents with contingent name just in case an agent can't step up, because the agent is under no obligation to accept the power towards the, they could change their mind and say, look, I live in another state. I don't really have the ability to do this. I don't want to.
Exactly.
So that's where the contingent agents would step in. Similar to a will, as you told us about earlier, where people named in your will to act as a guardian for your children or the disposition of your property is more a suggestion to the court. Does the POA differ in that it is a legally binding document for the people named in there? They do have that power, and they don't have to go to court and ask for the power.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, the reason that we do powers of attorney is to keep it out of court, because the default is a conservatorship through the probate court, what we might call living probate. And so in the absence of a power of attorney, the conservator then applies to the court and hopefully gets appointed as the conservator. Then they can do everything that the agent under the financial power of attorney could do, except that you've got the court expense and delay involved.
Now, another thing I've been told about power of attorney forms themselves is that the power is granted immediately and not necessarily only at incapacitation. Is that true, that as soon as the power form has been signed and is I guess authorized or activated, the agent theoretically has access to those assets?
It's going to depend upon the terms of the power of attorney. So something called a springing power of attorney is the common word for it, and that would be someone would be appointed as agent upon the incapacity. That is, they spring into effect when they become incapacitated, as determined by whatever their criteria in the power of attorney is. The others are active right now. So very often the power of attorney says, I name my son to be my agent under my power of attorney, and it is not contingent on incapacity. So that son has the legal authority at that moment to conduct the financial business of the principal.
Which one do you see more often, a springing where the agent doesn't have the power until incapacitation actually happens, or I guess for a non-springing, is that what it's called?
Can be, yeah. I mean, I think that's descriptive.
What do you see more often, springing or non-springing POAs?
See more often the non-springing, and here's the reason. The financial institutions, transfer agents, are reluctant to give effect to the powers of attorney. They don't want to be sued. Now, they're following the power of attorney, but if this power of attorney is old, defined by some banks as 6 months, others a couple years, they don't know if we're using father and son again. They don't know if father and son are even still talking. And so the son shows up in the bank and says, I want to empty out dad's account. They're reluctant to act on that, and primarily because of potential liability. Now, they're probably protected because the document is there. But if it is contingent upon the principal, dad in this case, being proved to be incapacitated, then they're going to be reluctant until there's proof satisfactory to them. And that may not be as low a hurdle as you might expect. The other thing that we run into very often is that when you open a bank account, I'm just use that as an example. Say that you go to Wells Fargo, for example, a national bank. When you open that account, in the account opening documents, the account card or whatever it may be called, you've agreed that California law will apply, even though you may be in Colorado. The bank is in Colorado. Everybody you know is in Colorado. And so whether or not that power of attorney will be given effect is going to depend on California law, not Colorado law. And in addition to that, you have agreed that if there's any dispute or controversy over that particular account, including the use of a power of attorney, that will be resolved in San Francisco, California.
So what you're saying is, though, all the documents that you sign that pretty much nobody ever reads, somewhere buried in that document is that, hey, we bank XYZ, the laws of our state of domicile,
right?
And in the case you're given just happens to be California, the laws of our state of domicile apply in this particular situation, not necessarily the laws of the state in which you reside.
Yes, and the power of attorney can say the laws of Colorado apply, but that doesn't override the agreement with the bank on that particular account.
Well, that brings me to the last thing that I want listeners to understand about power of attorneys, and this is kind of a pet peeve of mine, Pete, and you've tried to help me out with this, because we go to great lengths, probably more lengths than most other planning firms, to get our clients to have POAs, because there's nothing more than I don't want to do than have to sit across the table from someone I know and listen to them share to me that their husband or their wife or their child is incapacitated and they need to help them. And they're saying, Jim, I need $30,000 from his or her account. And I have to sit here and say, sorry, I can't give it to you. The custodian controls the account, not me. I'm just the advisor. I don't control the money. The custodian does. And the custodian is not going to release it because you don't have a power of attorney form. So we go to great lengths to get our clients to produce these. The unfortunate thing is so many people say to me either this, Pete, oh, I have one. And I'll say, when did you get it? Oh, we got it 12 years ago. And they think they're okay. They have a 12-year-old document. And I try to tell them that's not going to be honored. And they look at me surprisingly. And I say the same thing you just alluded to. I'll tell them, look, the custodian is not going to honor a power you granted these people 12 years ago. They don't know if anything has changed since then. And ostensibly, they're looking out for you. But in reality, they're probably trying to look out for themselves. And they're not going to honor a document that is this old. So we encourage people with a POA more than a few years old to go back and reactivate it or redo it or update it, whatever the legal term is, and have it newly signed.
Correct.
And beginning with that newly signed, we are going to reaffirm it for them every year. This was a recommendation you made to me several years ago that we have been doing. When we come back, I want to talk about what reaffirmation means. I want people to understand that if you have a power of attorney for property and that thing is more than a few years old, your spouse or your agent or your child, whoever is named, is going to find it incredibly difficult to act on your behalf, and it defeats the purpose of putting the power of attorney in the position in the first place. The important thing is not to have one. It is also to have one and reaffirm it every single year.